What kind of fun is waiting for you at King's Island? The, holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The, make a splash all summer kind of fun. The, I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at King's Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun this season. King's Island is now open weekends.
Welcome back to Defining Us, a special series for Cricut Conversations exploring Latino identity, culture, misconceptions, and political power.
I'm Grace Parra.
And I'm Julissa Arce.
If you listen to our first episode, then you'll know that Latinos, Chicanos, and Latinx people have a long history in America, since before it was even called America. So for this episode, we want to talk about the contributions of Latinx people during the civil rights movement, moments in the fight for equality that are very often overlooked and certainly not included in U.S. history books.
We'll discuss how empowering it feels to learn that not only were we there in the protest, marches, and fight for freedom, but some of the key moments in the civil rights era happened because of the leadership of Chicano and Latino leaders. So what does that mean to us now? And what can we learn from those fights and the struggles we face today? How can we take ownership in this era of civil rights? To help us get into this and more, we'll be speaking with one of the iconic leaders of the 1968 East LA walkouts, Moctezuma Esparza.
We'll also be talking to 17-year-old activist Grace Dolan Sandrino, a young advocate for the LGBTQ community who is doing some incredible work right now. Guys, what an exciting few days we've had. The response from episode one has been so incredible. We are over the moon. Thank you guys so much for tuning in, for sending us all of your feedback. We are so excited about the series. And it's been an incredible experience. Julissa, how's the feedback been from your angle?
It's amazing. I am so happy of people writing us and tweeting at us and telling us how much they love feeling seen, and like so many of the things that we talked about were things that they have felt and conversations they've had with their friends. And then I also love the response from non-Latinx people who are like, we're loving the series, and I'm so glad that we're having so many people listen. So thank you for listening, and Keep listening
and keep sending us compliments, especially about our beauty, because that is why we do this. Perfect faces for podcasts. So we're excited to delve today into the civil rights movement and the place that Latinos have historically, both in the past and also in the present. And Julissa, you shared with me a story that I just feel like our audience needs to hear about your perspective and kind of like your first few moments of realizing your place with regard to the civil rights movement. So tell us a little bit about what got you interested in this time in history.
So I was in seventh grade, and this kid named Justin, I'll like never forget his name or his face.
Justin.
But this kid named Justin, I was placed in this like honors math class. And it was like the only place in seventh grade where I felt smart, because I still didn't know how to speak English. And so I would like fail open book test. Mm-hmm. But in math, like I felt smart because, you know, 2 + 2 = 4 in any language.
Yeah.
And so I had been placed in this honors math class, and Justin raises his hand and he says, "Why is she in the honors math class? She's a Mexican." And I was stunned because I was not prepared to face any kind of racism, because up until then I thought that racism was a dynamic exclusively between Black and white people. Mm-hmm. And that's for several reasons. One, my parents never sat me down and told me, you know, racism exists in this country. Like, we never had this conversation about us being Mexican, or about what that meant in America, or racism. Like, we just never had that conversation. Mm-hmm. So that's one reason why I was like stunned and not ready for it. Mm-hmm. The second reason is because when I was learning about the civil rights movement, I really only learned about the civil rights movement, again, in sort of this very binary dynamic. Mm-hmm. And I remember like asking myself, what fountain did we drink from?
Oh my God.
Because it wasn't in my books.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, like, what fountain did like the Asian kids that were in class with me, like, what did they drink from? And when we were learning about like the Chinese, for example, we learned about them building the railroad, but not what kind of discrimination they may have faced. And we know that they did, right? And so I just wasn't prepared for it because I just didn't know that that existed in the past. And so then I started sort of answering these questions. And I realized that as an adult, I still had these questions that I had when I was in seventh grade about what was our place, like where do we fit in the civil rights era? Like, did we take on any of those fights? And if we didn't, then why? And what I found is that there's so many instances of things that we are fighting for today, whether it's in healthcare or education or immigration, that were being fought in the civil rights era. And to me, like, I had such a sense of empowerment knowing that we've always had this place in America, and we have been leaders in pushing for equality and for freedom, and we've been there. And that was really empowering for me to learn about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we understand that Latinos have faced discrimination. That's had an impact on every element of the way that we live. But what we don't really hear about are the victories and the impact that we've had in the greater scale. You've talked about some of the current immigration laws being, you know, relevant now. Tell us about some of the current immigration issues that you think stand out most for the Latino community.
Well, I think, you know, when we talk about immigration, we have to understand that immigration laws have always been rooted in race, right? So, like, going back to, like, the 1700s, like 1790, the definition of a citizen was a free white person is who could be a citizen. So, like, starting from there, this immigration laws have always had a root in race. What's interesting to me about what's happening today is that there continues to be so much racism within the immigration system that we try to cover up and say has nothing to do with race, right? So, like, if you take a look at, like, SB4 in Texas.
In Texas, our home state, yeah.
Our home state.
Shout out to Greg Abbott. Just kidding. I mean, I'm shouting him out, but in a bad way.
Oh, that guy.
That guy, man. That guy. Tell us.
So, you know, Greg Abbott has just been, like, the worst in Texas, and Ken Paxton, his attorney general.
Yeah.
So people go out to vote and vote them both freaking out of office.
Yes.
But under their regime, we had this very overtly racist law, SB4, which basically said that the police could stop people and ask them for their immigration status. And they could do so if, you know, if you, not even if you had, like, committed a crime, can I ask you about your immigration status? But if I think that you could commit a crime, I can ask you about your immigration status, which is bullshit and racist. But what they will say is that, no, these laws aren't racist, but I'm sorry. Like, who's going to get stopped and asked about their immigration status if not people that look like you and me?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's one thing. That's one of the laws that is, like, immigration law that is clearly racist. And what's crazy to me is to think back to some of the fights, the civil rights fights that we've had, you know, not that long ago in California. We had Prop 187, which was, like, a very similar law to SB4. And that was fought and defeated. But then now we have a renewed sense that these things can happen in our country. And we're seeing that they're winning, right? Because this law is right now going on in Texas. And it's happening in Texas.
Right. I've seen, actually, my parents go through something very specific. They live in, this is going to sound douchey, but it's context. My parents live in a gated community in Houston. And under Jesus Christ, I mean, just in the last few months, one of the biggest things that's kind of rocked their neighborhood is that the neighborhood independently decided to require anybody coming into the neighborhood to show their license and registration. And this affected specifically the people who work in this neighborhood, who are gardeners and who are housekeepers and who may themselves be undocumented, who are now struggling to be able to even enter the neighborhood to do their job because they're cracking down. And my dad told me about this, and he was like, I know why they're doing this. They're clearly trying to hit the undocumented community and shame them or to not let them in. But what they don't seem to realize is that they are the backbone of the labor force in this community. So the second that, you know, you request somebody's papers to get into the neighborhood, well, maybe you're not going to have a gardener then, you know, and all the like amenities that you've grown accustomed to in your own neighborhood, you're not going to have. So my dad was like, look, I obviously like I hire who I hire to do these things for us. I'm not going to stop that. So he has offered personally to take anybody from, you know, his who works on the house, whether it's, you know, a pool guy or housekeeper, and he'll go pick them up to then bring them into the neighborhood, which is an extra step that he shouldn't have to do. But the reality is this crackdown in Texas is really affecting a lot of people, including my parents, and they're not going to stand for that personally.
Yeah, but you know what? Also, like, fuck that, because,
yeah,
like, we shouldn't care for people to be able to go to work just so that we can have like these amenities, you know? It's like,
yeah,
these are fucking human beings,
yeah,
who are working, who deserve to make a living.
Yeah.
And that's why we should care and push back against these renewed attempts to racialize immigration laws.
Right.
That make it okay. These laws are making it okay to discriminate on the basis of race.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't care how much you tell me that SB4 is not racist.
Mm-hmm.
It is a racist law.
Yeah. It's racist and it's anti-immigrant. And those things go hand in hand.
Yes.
So we are seeing, obviously, echoes of civil rights issues in the past that are haunting us to this day. What are some others that strike you as ills that we have yet to cure?
Well, one of the, you know, we're going to be talking to Makhda Suma Sparsa, mm-hmm, about this.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that when I learned about it, I was like, oh, my God, I had no idea that this even happened, was this walkouts in 1968.
Right.
That, you know, 22,000 students walked out. And the things that they were protesting and the things they were walking out for are
here in East LA.
Mm-hmm. The things that they were fighting for. It breaks my heart to know that they're the very things that we are still fighting for today. So some of the things that, you know, they were fighting for back then was making sure that the history that they were learning about reflected their experiences and it reflected their backgrounds and their history,
mm-hmm,
because the school districts that they were studying in were like, you know, 90-something% Latino, and yet the history that they were learning had no Latinx history, Chicano history in them. And so they were fighting, one, to be able to learn in school the history that was being taught to them at home.
Mm-hmm.
They were fighting to be able to speak Spanish in school.
Mm-hmm.
They were fighting to have better classrooms, to not have 4,000 students assigned to a single college counselor. They were fighting so that they weren't told that because they were Latino that they shouldn't think about college and they should just think about going to work.
These are all relevant today.
Yes.
These are all fights that are still happening. It's shocking to see how little progress has been made. The bilingual thing actually makes me, you mentioned the fact that Spanish.
People will get hit for speaking Spanish.
So fucked up, man. Yeah, and you know, regarding bilingualism, one thing I learned is, so New Mexico became a state in 1912. And when it became a state, it actually registered not one but two languages as the official state languages, both English and Spanish, something I didn't know at all. So to go from a place where historically bilingualism was not only accepted but embraced and taken as a standard condition for a state, to devolve to a place where children are being swatted for speaking that language publicly is really fucked up.
Yeah, and like today you still have people who are told that they should go back to where they came from.
Yep.
Because they're speaking Spanish in the workplace, and it's like, you idiot, these, you know, those people were like, the specific instance that I'm thinking about, it's like these people were Puerto Rican and they were speaking Spanish and mm-hmm. they're being told to go back to where they came from, and it's like, I am where I came from.
Yeah. Also, I have to call out something you and I've talked about, but the strange commodification of bilingualism and trilingualism, where now you can speak another language, but it should be French or German or something that's a little bit sexier. And the kids who speak multiple languages are ones whose parents pay out of pocket for them,
like
to go
a lot
to,
of money,
like a lot of money. It's something that like wealthy kids do. It's mm-hmm. it's been commodified. I mean, really, they've put a barrier to entry, I think, yeah. for a lot of students.
The other thing of like education that, you know, I am a huge advocate for education and viewing education as a human right, as mm-hmm. something that every person should have access to, and that every person should have access to a quality education.
Right.
And what's so disheartening, even all these years later, after amazing leaders have fought for this way back in the 60s, is that, yes, we've made some progress, mm-hmm. but when you look at the schools that Latino students go to, they are some of the most underfunded schools yeah. in the country. And there's also this idea that, you know, I think when we look back in history and like think back to like Brown versus Board of Education, for example, right? And we think that schools were desegregated because of Board versus Brown of Education. And there's two things that stand out to me. One is that, you know, 7 years before Brown versus Board of Education, there was a case in California, Mendez versus Westminster, in which a Mexican-American student wanted to go to an all-white school, mm-hmm. and she was not allowed to. And so this case went all the way up to the California Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And the Mexican-American family, they won. Mm-hmm. And so, and then the judge that presided over that case went on to become a Supreme Court justice that presided over Brown versus Board of Education. So like, you know, the thing is, it didn't start with Brown versus Board of Education, but it also didn't end there. Mm-hmm. Because then, you know, Martin Luther King talks about this in his book, Why We Can't Wait. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the fact that even after Board versus Brown of Education, only 9% of schools in the South were desegregated, like 9 years after right, that. Right. And that if they continued at that same pace, it wouldn't be until 2054 when schools would be desegregated. And I'm sitting here thinking, like, Martin Luther King, you would be so sad, because let me tell you how segregated schools still are.
Yeah.
So we might actually yeah. be on pace for that 2054, you know?
Hopefully.
Because, and this is what I mean about laws being, there's this sort of like veil of justice mm-hmm. that is told to us mm-hmm. where really what's behind the curtain is racism, right? Yeah. So like even with schools, like, yeah, schools are, it is illegal to desegregate schools. But when you look at schools and the way that districts are drawn,
yep.
then you can kind of see a through line that is very racialized, right? Okay. So like, schools continue to be incredibly segregated, except now we say, well, it has nothing to do with race. It has to do with like where you live. And so where you live is where you go to school. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, but then you have to take a look at why are those districts drawn that way in the first place? Like, why do people live where they live? Like, right. why, you know, are some neighborhoods, why are the schools at some neighborhoods still, you know, I run a scholarship fund in New York. Mm-hmm. And we give scholarships to immigrant students regardless of their immigration status. And I'm very proud to say that we've given out almost $500,000 in the
Ooh.
Last 6 years.
Oh, we get it. You help kids.
Yeah, perfect, and it's amazing. But you know what's kind of crazy is mm-hmm. that in some of the schools where we get applications from, some of the schools still do not have a college counselor. In the entire school, there is not a college counselor. And you want to know, the majority of the students that go to those schools are Latino and Black students.
The expectation being that they aren't ready for college, that they don't belong in college, that they don't have the resources to go to college, so why bother? That
and also,
is.
Also, that's where they also, those schools don't get any money.
If anything, those are the students, I think, who need college counselors even more, because
right.
they're the ones who need additional support and help and guidance to get into college.
Right, because many of them are first generation college students. They yeah. don't have yeah. someone at home that can guide them and tell them how to get into college.
Right. It's a budget thing, too. I mean, these schools can't necessarily afford to fill those positions. And, you know, college is probably the first conversations about going to college has to be one of the first things to go when you just don't have a big budget.
So it was crazy to me about what we were talking about in like episode one, about the things that Latinos care about and immigration not being like the number one most important issue. Of course, it's a big issue, and I don't want to lose sight of that. But mm-hmm. Education was like a big one. Mm-hmm. And so much of what drives educational equality and drives access to education is where you live.
Right.
And
that goes back to housing discrimination that you know, that the African American community was fighting for in the 60s, and getting the housing, the Fair Housing Act passed, right? And so much of that was because you didn't have access to loans, and people wouldn't sell you homes in white neighborhoods, mm-hmm. right? People would say, like, I remember, so Cory Booker has this amazing story about his parents and how his parents bought a home in a white neighborhood only because they had their, like, white friend go buy the home for them. Mm-hmm. Because up until that point, they kept asking their realtor to show them homes in certain neighborhoods. And right. the realtor would be like, that home's sold already. It's not available anymore. And it wasn't that it wasn't available. It's that it wasn't available to them.
To them,
because
yeah.
they were black buyers.
Right.
And, you know, some very similar things
Did you
happened
have any experiences
in the community.
Like that growing up? What was your experience with housing when you were growing up?
So I didn't grow up, like, I don't know, like, my neighborhood. So first of all, I grew up in San Antonio, Texas, mm-hmm. where there's more Mexican restaurants than there are McDonald's, first of all.
Love that.
And so there were a lot of people that looked like me and that were from different socioeconomic backgrounds, mm-hmm. right? I think that there's this idea that, like, if you live in a Latino neighborhood, that then you must live in a, like, low-income neighborhood.
Which is not the case.
Right? Yeah. And in my experience, like, I went to school, and in my high school, for example, there were like Range Rovers in the student parking lot, mm-hmm. but then there were also, you know, kids who were like on free lunch.
Right.
So there was like a huge
socioeconomic diversity.
Right.
Which is pretty rare, and I think special. I mean, that sets you up for understanding that regardless of what your racial or ethnic background is, that socioeconomic background, there's like a range of origin for people as well.
Yeah. But I was, you know, I was very fortunate that the neighborhood that we lived in had a really great school, like a really great public school mm-hmm. to go to. And so my last 2 years of high school, I went to this really amazing school. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, then a lot of my friends that I met in college that were Latino students that came from like San Antonio, their experience going to school and like the neighborhoods that they lived in was so crazy. Mm-hmm. And it was so different than my experience. Mm-hmm. And the horror stories that I would hear just even about the conditions like in the cafeteria and the bathrooms. And it was a stark difference. And yeah. that's what I mean about, like, if you are born into a certain zip code mm-hmm. and you go to the schools that zip code is assigned to, then you're going to have a very different experience mm-hmm. than somebody else who happened to have been born into a different zip code. And that's what people in the 60s were fighting for, was to say where you are born mm-hmm. shouldn't determine your entire life. Mm-hmm. Right. It shouldn't affect everything you're going to do for the rest of your life.
Right. And yet it does.
Right.
In many cases. Okay. Let's talk about a couple of other things. One thing that you brought to my attention, a story that I wasn't aware of, that I think is one of the more interesting historical victories of Latinos. Actually, there's a story about cheerleaders that's very mm-hmm. interesting, because you also were a cheerleader, right, mm-hmm. growing up. So there's maybe a point of entry there that was of interest to you. So tell us about your experience being a cheerleader, and then, like, why this one particular case back in the 60s, I believe it was so impactful for Latinos.
So first of all, I want to say I became a cheerleader because I thought that that's what you did when you were an American girl.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be an all-American girl. Because
I wanted to be Kelly Kapowski.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I became a cheerleader because that's what I thought
yeah.
I needed to do to, like, fit in. And not, it wasn't so much just about, like, the whole, like, you know, like, I want to be popular mm-hmm. in high school. It was really about, like, I want to be American. And so
yeah.
I'm a cheerleader.
Yeah.
What's crazy, though, it's like, even the this is drives me crazy, because even the fact that I could be a cheerleader, being a Mexican American, there is a reason why I could do that.
Right.
And the reason that I could do that is because of really brave students in the 1960s who stood up against racism and were like, we're going to be cheerleaders. Because in Crystal City, Texas, in the 60s, mm-hmm.
There was like in 1969, there were two vacancies on the cheerleading squad. Mm-hmm. And so the two Mexican-American girls were like, we want to be cheerleaders. Mm-hmm. And the administration told them, sorry, you can't be cheerleaders because we already met our quota of one Mexican-American cheerleader on the squad.
Oh, my God. I'm like paralyzed with anxiety thinking about that. That's so terrible.
And then of course, you know, the whole community was like up in arms about this. So they were like, sorry, we don't mean to be racist. So we take that back. It's not about the quota. It's actually because we require the parent of a cheerleader, at least one parent, to have a high school diploma.
Oh, sure. Because that affects the ability of a 15-year-old girl to cheer.
Right. And yes, to jump yes. high.
And to jump
to
high.
And to do the splits. Like, yeah.
Cool, cool, cool. That makes sense. Way to go.
And the reason they did this is because they knew that most of the Latino parents in the community did not have high school diplomas because they were farm workers.
Right.
And they actually, they also like held elections because these were like farm workers that moved. So they would follow the harvest season around the country. Mm-hmm. And so they would hold elections for school board when these parents and this community were gone, when they were gone like to California.
Oh my God. And this was all an attempt to not appear Latino to the outside world. Right. Right.
And to keep people, I mean, it's all about like, you know, keeping people in their place. Like,
right.
You shouldn't be a cheerleader. Like, that's not what you're...
You're just going to be a farmhand anyway. So why, right. you don't need that fluff.
Right. But what's amazing terrible. And what's so inspiring to me about these walkouts in Crystal City, Texas, mm-hmm. is that, you know what, we won.
Like, yeah.
The cheerleaders were able to become cheerleaders. Mm-hmm. Like, they led this amazing walkout. Mm-hmm. So even people from California traveled to Texas to join them mm-hmm. in this fight because they knew that it wasn't just about being cheerleaders.
Right.
It was about having equal access to opportunities in schools. Mm-hmm. And they were able to lead real change in their district. And they changed the way that people could become cheerleaders, and they got rid of all this bullshit requirements for becoming cheerleaders. And they also had huge changes in the makeup of their school board.
Right.
Because they demanded that they had more teachers that looked like them. They demanded that the school board was more representative of the community. And this was in the 60s, right? And so just knowing that the reason I could be a cheerleader in 1998 was because these people in 1969 stood up to bullshit and racism, and they won.
And they won. You know, the school board element that you're mentioning, too, is so important because as we are about to walk into midterms, we talk, there's just a sort of like air of how important certain elections are. And they're always the big federal elections, you know, it's always president or it's even senator, but it's never for the kind of smaller positions mm-hmm. like school boards that I think are so much more impactful, not more impactful, but just as impactful on a much more accessible scale. And I say that because one of the big incentives, one of the big things that we're doing here with this podcast is to remind people about voter registration and about voting in your elections, regardless of the size of the election itself. And with midterms around the corner, mm-hmm. a lot of people are going to have the opportunity to vote in these smaller elections. So look at this as an example of what voting for a school board member can do very directly.
Yeah.
Very, very, very directly. That's why another reason I'm so glad you shared that story.
Yeah. And I also think I think so many times, and I know a lot of the things that we're talking about today in this episode are heavy, and they're like things that I know would make me angry if I was listening to it. But I think it's also important to remind ourselves of what's possible.
Absolutely, absolutely,
and to remind ourselves that we've had fights in the past that we've won, mm-hmm. and we should find some hope in that.
Yeah,
and hope to know that just like, you know, these cheerleaders in the 60s got the rights to bear pom-poms, mm-hmm. we can win, we can win our right to do a lot of things right now. We can win the right to, like, live wherever we want, to not be discriminated against, to not walk into a freaking bank and get charged more interest just because we are people of color, even though, you know, we have 800 credit scores.
Right. I don't. I wish I did, but made some mistakes in my youth. But yeah, I mean, I think two key points that we want to bring up here. Number one, voting and getting to the polls is huge with regard to making change. And the second is that organizing is such such a pivotal step, because all these stories that you're mentioning, Julissa, don't involve just one person being like, I'm going to change the face of the world. It involves leaders gathering people together in groups to impact change. You can be your own advocate, but we're all stronger together. So, yeah. I mean, even you and I in creating this podcast realize that our voices together can make more of an impact than we can individually. That's been a really special thing to carry through each of these episodes. So, yeah, is there some heft to what we're talking about today? Absolutely. But it's important. It's important to just sit down and learn the history and listen to these stories.
And be empowered by them.
And be empowered and by them. Like, exactly.
Injected with hope by these stories.
Yes.
I know I have been like,
oh my God. Yes. And our guests today, by the way, are people whose stories, one of whom has been an advocate for 50 plus years, one of whom is 17 years old today, or rather turning 18 in the next week. And these people represent a kind of broad swath of what activism means today for the Latino community. And we're so excited to share our interviews with them too. Julissa, you know, one of the most important things we do for our health every day is brushing our teeth. I'm a big fan. I brush 3, 4, 12 times a day.
I wonder if it's such an important thing that we do every day. How come there aren't like lessons on how to brush your teeth, like in school or something?
Oh, well, I think that there are, but I think they're bad lessons. Like I remember fake brushing an apple with a toothbrush. I don't know why I did that. I went to an Amish school, clearly. Quip, though, guys. Quip. Quip is a better electric toothbrush created by dentists and designers. And
teeth designers.
Teeth designers.
As we established.
Yes, by teeth designers. And it was designed to make brushing your teeth more simple, more affordable, and even enjoyable. Although I find teeth brushing generally enjoyable. So Quip, I'm with you on that importance. People brush too hard. I do that. Some electric toothbrushes are too abrasive, but with Quip, a built-in 2-minute timer pulses every 30 seconds to remind you when to switch sides. Ooh, that sounds sexual. Which helps guide a full and even clean. Now, Quip doesn't even require a clunky charger. It runs for 3 months on one charge.
That's the thing I hate most about my electronic toothbrush, because... Well, I'm going to get on it.
Gotta
I'm
going to get Quip.
I'm going to get Quip. And I'm finally going to do it. I'm going to get a Quip, because having to travel with a electronic toothbrush that weighs like 3 pounds is ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. Also, Quip is one of the first electric toothbrushes accepted by the ADA, and it has thousands of verified 5-star reviews. They're also backed by over 20,000 dental professionals. So get on this, guys. Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/crookedconvos right now, you get your first refill pack for free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That is your first refill pack for free at getquip.com/crookedconvos.
Grace.
Julissa.
Let me tell you about Stitch Fix. Stitch Fix is an online personal styling service that finds and delivers clothes, shoes, and accessories to fit your body, budget, and lifestyle.
Body.
I need a lot of help with that.
I need a lot of help
with that. I don't know how to style.
I have the body of a pygmy, the budget of a non-working kindergartner, and the lifestyle of a Kardashian.
Oh, wow.
I'll have the money for it, but man.
That's quite the formula. But I still think that Stitch Fix could help you with all of that. So just go to stitchfix.com/crookedconvos and tell them your sizes, what styles you like, and how much you want to spend on each item.
That's interesting, because I will throw down for a good jacket and a good pair of jeans, but I don't want to spend more than like, I don't know, $75-$80 on a purse. I'm not one of these ladies that likes to spend lots of money on a handbag.
They're investments. I feel like if I ever went poor, I could like resell
really?
Some of my bags. Yeah.
Maybe I should do that.
Yeah. I also don't love pants. Because I don't have the booty for them.
Dude,
so I mostly do dresses.
I don't like pants either.
And Stitch Fix has sent me some pretty sweet dresses.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you'll be paired with your very own personal stylist who will handpick 5 items to send to your door. Then you try them on, pay only for what you love, and then return the rest. Shipping, exchanges, and returns are always free. There's no subscription required. You can sign up to receive scheduled shipments or get your fix wherever you want.
I see what you did there, Stitch Fix. I like it. Cheeky.
Stitch Fix styling fee is only $20, which is applied towards anything that you pick up from your shipment. So it's like basically free because they send you such cute things that you're going to want to keep them.
Dude.
So you're not going to have to pay the styling fee. But if you do have to pay it, it's only $20.
I got
to
get on this.
Get started now at stitchfix.com/crookedcombos/crookedcombos. And you'll earn an extra 25% off when you keep all five items in your box. That's stitchfix.com/crookedcombos to get started today. stitchfix.com/crookedcombos. stitchfix.com/crookedcombos. They had it in the copy like five times, so I just threw them an extra one.
There's also an exclamation point at the end of one of them, which I like a lot.
stitchfix.com/crookedcombos.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. The I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at Kings Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun this season. Kings Island is now open weekends.
So I'm so excited for this guest, Moctezuma Esparza. He is a real unsung hero from the civil rights era, just an incredible activist and icon from that time. He led one of the largest student walkouts in history. 22,000 students walked out in East LA to protest just terrible conditions in their high schools, from having such high dropout rates of 50% plus dropout rates. And he's just was so amazing in leading that fight. He is a Mexican-American producer, executive, and community activist. He's a producer on Selena, the movie. It's an amazing movie. And he's just done so much for our community. And I'm so excited to welcome him to today's Crooked Conversation. Right before we were going to start talking about the East LA walkouts, you said, I don't consider myself Latino.
That's
Can you
true.
Tell us more about that?
That's a bomb drop right there.
Well, I'm a Chicano.
Oh, okay.
Latino is a made-up construct of identity that emerged in the 70s in order to create a big tent to include Mexican-Americans, Chicanos, Puerto Ricans, Cubans, and Central Americans in a larger tent that it was basically promoted by commerce. It is a word that was promoted by those who were rejecting the word Hispanic, because that was promoted by the government, by the Republican administration in the Reagan years, in the Department of Commerce, that was more aimed at the use of the word to promote advertising in order to create a big tent in advertising. Latino was a word that was created for a big tent in social organizing and politics. And I participated in the creation of that word. And it was a calculated, conscious conversation that all of us had back then, because Chicanos, Mexican Americans, were the vast majority of all the people who could say they had commonality of having been subject to the conquest of Spain in Latin America. So we had a commonality of history and language in terms of the conquest. However, we were two-thirds of everybody. And we thought that collectively, we would all be better off by creating an identity that could be a big tent. But I did not intend back then, and I did not realize that it would mean the sacrifice and the loss of my identity as a Chicano.
And because you felt like the term Chicano and Latino were at odds or couldn't essentially coexist synonymously.
No, it's not that they don't. They can't coexist. It's one that Latino has become predominant and been widely accepted without a real understanding or consideration for why it came into existence as a word.
Can I ask you, even that identity, that Chicano identity, where did that come from? Because, like, for example, me, like, I was born in Mexico.
I was born in East L.A.
So is that the difference between
That's
being like
difference.
Mexican and Chicano?
That's right. Because they come from the same word. Okay. Mexican has as its origins Mexicano. All right. So the Aztecs did not call themselves Aztecs.
Right.
They called themselves Mexicas.
Mexicas. Right.
That's right.
I like that.
Mexica.
Mexica.
OK. Okay. Mexica becomes Mexicano, Mexico. And you look at the weak first syllable and it becomes Chicano. Hmm. Okay. So it's the same word. And that word is Nahuatl, the indigenous language. And so the growth of the Chicano movement, the growth of what happened 50 years ago, the civil rights struggle that emerged, was an indigenous struggle, mm-hmm. one where we were reclaiming our identity as indigenous people.
Okay, so in East LA, and coming back to these to this very historic walkout that I don't believe a lot of people know about, because I know that, you know, I didn't learn about them in school. Like,
right.
This was learning about the East LA walkouts was not something that was part of the civil rights conversation. Or you mentioned Crystal City, Texas, which we're going to talk about also. But that wasn't part of the civil rights conversation. So
for who was it not part of the civil rights conversation? Because it was part of ours.
Well, I think for millennials today, we're not hearing about this. We didn't grow up understanding any of this.
Right. So that's thank you for that. Thank you for that clarification, because it absolutely was part of the conversation. What I mean is, it is not something that we are learning in school as part of the civil rights history.
Well, that was one of the demands that we made back then, was to have our history included in the curriculum. So the context for the walkouts is that when I was growing up, we were not encouraged to go to college. We were not told that we could be professionals. We were not in any way promoted to do well in school. And the expectation was that we would be workers.
A labor force, basically.
We were a labor force. And the dropout rate for Chicanos and Chicanas back then was more than 50%. Mm-hmm. My class at Lincoln High School, which was a six-year high school, we started with 300. We were a winter class, which are smaller. That means we graduated in January. And only half graduated.
Wow. Hmm.
And only four went to a four-year college out of the 150. Four out of the original 300. And that was the highest number that went to a four-year college up until that moment from Lincoln.
Wow.
That I knew of.
Wow.
Okay? So typically it was one or two from the summer classes, which were double in size, or maybe one from our class, the winter classes, that might have gone to college. Mm-hmm. And I was valedictorian. I had a high GPA. I did very well in my test. And my counselors said, you shouldn't go to UCLA where you've been admitted because you're not going to do well. You're not ready for that. Maybe you should go to a junior college. Now, I'm the valedictorian who scored, you know, in the top 2% of my SAT cohort, and without, you know, any prepping or taking private classes or anything like that. So, and I had a father who told me that, you know, that education was how I would be able to create my life, and mm-hmm. who promoted that. And so that was the strength that I had to ignore that advice and to have it fuel my anger and see clearly that although maybe I might do well, that the rest of my classmates were being denied.
Right. Mm. So there's a sentiment of submission, basically, being pushed into submission.
We accepted our place and of being just workers.
Right.
We accepted it. It was the psychological prison of the continuation of both the conquest, right? Because typically we were darker. We were more indígena, right? More mestizo. Mm-hmm. There were some güeros. Mm-hmm. And they were in the same boat as we, because we were also then part of this historical phenomenon of the United States war against Mexico, where the Southwest was taken. Okay. And if you were a Mexican, you were to be dispossessed. Mm-hmm. Right. So we had that as a context. So whether or not you were a Californio who were here before 1848, when the United States won the war, or you were a Manito in Nuevo Mexico, or you were a Tejano, right? We were all in the same boat. And that boat was is that we weren't going to be professionals. We weren't going to go to college. We weren't going to have our contributions honored or acknowledged or even acknowledging that the California Constitution, when it was formed in 1849, was originally in Spanish as well as English. Mm-hmm. None of this history was being taught.
Right. So at what point did you say, well, we have to take some action here because
the
this...
The times were transformative, mm-hmm. right? So this is 1968 March when the walkout happened. Mm-hmm. This is less than 3 years after the Watts riots, mm-hmm. okay? It is less than a few years from the Black Power movement, mm-hmm. The free speech movement, the women's rights movement, the anti-war movement. It was the time.
Right. There was a sense, there was a, an overall, the pulse was one of take action against the injustices that you're feeling, regardless of your identity, your background. If you're feeling as a community that there is action to be taken, now's the time.
It was the time. And it mm-hmm. was also a comparison and reference to our sense that we in the city, as Chicanos, were being completely overlooked and ignored mm-hmm. because if anyone was getting attention, it was the farm workers. It was Cesar Chavez. Mm-hmm. And we weren't farm workers.
Right.
We were not in the fields. And 80% of all Mexicanos, Chicanos, were urban. Mm-hmm. But the only attention that was being provided was to the farm workers. And we were also appreciative that our parents, many of them had been farm workers. Mm-hmm. Right. And so we did identify with the farm workers. And I was trained by Cesar Chavez's people as an organizer from the age of about 15, 14. Mm-hmm. And so that was part of my background in that I went on the march from Delano to Sacramento, mm-hmm. The famous march yeah. that Cesar Chavez had in mm-hmm. 1966, I think it was.
So you were in high school at the time?
Yeah, I was in high school and I was on that march.
One last question I have, and then I don't know if you have more, Grace.
Yeah.
But, one last question I have is, I'm wondering whether you see the East LA walkouts as a framework that students are now utilizing for their own protest. And when I see like the Parkland students in Florida who led walkouts and they were able to organize walkouts throughout the country in support of their cause, do you think that the East LA
Absolutely.
Walkouts provided that framework?
There were walkouts that continued in East LA to this day. And it went to from East LA to San Antonio, to Chicago, to New York, to Denver, to Albuquerque, all over the country. Within 2 years, we heard of walkouts all over the country, and I spent a year traveling the United States organizing and taking the message, right? And Corky Gonzalez in Denver had a youth leadership conference where people came from all over the United States. Puerto Ricans, the Young Lords came and worked with us. People from Mexico City, some of whom were killed in Tlatelolco, we got to know. It became an international and a national movement, which was huge. Mm-hmm. We were part of the mainstream of the civil rights movement of the 60s. And we were in the news and part of that whole conversation. It is ironic and sad and tragic that you tell me that 50 years later, you haven't heard about it, you weren't taught it, and that I'm here sharing things with you for the first time that were transformative and that are in large measure why you came to the United States and ended up getting a college education because of what we did 50 years ago.
Yeah, well, that's why we wanted to talk to you. Because,
yes.
Because you know, I know that I didn't learn it in school, but I knew and I had so many questions about where were Latinos during the civil rights movement? And so I took it upon myself to go find out. And learning about this walkout inspired me so much to know that not only did we have a place in the civil rights movement, but that we were leaders, that you were a leader in that civil rights movement. And exactly what you said, that the reason I was able to go to college and have a college education and the reason so many more Latinos are going to college now is because of these walkouts. And we want to make sure that all of our listeners and that they share it with their friends and family so that people know more about this rich, amazing history. Because this year we are celebrating the 50th year anniversary of the walkout.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why aren't we making a bigger deal about this? And so thank you so much for being here and for sharing all of this with us.
And our next guest today is a 17-year-old Afro-Latina trans teen LGBTQ activist and advocate for marginalized youth. This young woman has done so much work already in her life. It is absolutely incredible. And so we wanted to talk to her about a number of things. She's not only been an ambassador to the White House Initiative on Educational Excellence for African Americans under the Obama administration, but she also serves on the Kennedy Center Youth Council, the Aspen Institute's National Youth Commission on SEED, and she's received the title of Young Futurist from The Root for 2017. She's also a writer, and you can see many of her pieces in Teen Vogue. We're so excited to have her with us today, Grace Dolan-Sandrino.
I feel like you're fighting so many different fights, right? Being a woman of color, being trans, and so many of these labels within the Latinx community. You know, there's so much racism within our community. There's so much homophobia and transphobia, and I'm wondering whether... I'm wondering how you deal with that and how you advocate for yourself within the Latinx community that tends to be, like I said, very homophobic and very transphobic. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you push back against that within our own community?
Well, within our own community, I first have to approach any table with this energy of understanding. One, understanding your pre-existing conceptions and understanding of me. And then two, asking for respect from whoever I'm sitting across from to understand me and understand my story. Mm-hmm. I think something that is lacking in a lot of spaces across our nation right now, across the globe, is civil discourse. And that disagreement is beautiful. And that disagreement can really be transformative and have long-lasting effects if after we disagree, we leave with something. So when I come to a table to have a discussion, I'm coming to give some education and also be educated. So whenever I'm sitting at a table with someone having a discussion, there has to be that there first, that mutual respect and that basis of importance on both sides. But then I will not sacrifice anything that I have to say about myself, about my identity, just because someone else doesn't agree with it. And that's okay. But at the end of the day, I need to demand that respect and demand that even if you do not care, that you listen. I think that a lot of the times when we're trying to have conversations, that fear of disagreement either stops us from having those conversations altogether, or once we get to the point where we don't agree, we end. Mm-hmm. I mean, when we end, we've ended on this bad note where we both have bad taste in our mouths and we don't want to revisit. And then in that, we just drive that prejudice deeper and deeper and deeper without leaving with any sort of understanding or enlightenment. And I think that it's not specific to the Latinx community, that it's not specific to the Black community, that it's not specific to the mixed community, that it's not specific to the trans community or the straight and the LGBTQ community and their discussions, that it's a universal principle. Stressing that idea of universality. I'm not sure if that's, I don't know if that's the right word, but.
Oh yeah, I think that's totally appropriate there, yeah.
Kind of this just across the board concept of respect.
This tenor of respect that you're speaking of, I think is really striking, and especially hearing you as a 17, almost 18-year-old speak about it, you know, the maturity that you're speaking the mature tone that you're taking is something that I think just so many generations so much older than you don't have at all. And that's something that we wanted to talk about, because your generation, I think, is at least sort of universally known to be more understanding. Are you finding that? I mean, obviously hearing about the stories of being bullied at 13, kids are going to be fucking assholes kind of in any generation. But do you find that overall your generation, Gen Z, has more of a tenor of responsibility and respect for each other?
100%.
Interesting. Okay, yeah, tell us a little bit
generation
about that.
Generation Z is the most intersectional generation in identity and ethnicity to exist to date. And because of those intersectional identities, we have more places of meeting. We have more grounds of understanding each other. Mm-hmm. But also, not just our intersectionality, but the rise of the internet and the rise of internet communities and the ability to talk to somebody who is across the country or across the globe from you, who is going through something similar to what you're going through, which was not possible just a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. And our ability to really take advantage of the internet and become organizers together. And in becoming organizers together on the internet, something that young people are using, mm-hmm. we learn how to educate from afar. We learn how to make new resources. We learn how to make communities and communities that are welcoming. Yeah. And I think that there's no doubt that Generation Z is extremely educated. We are very active. Mm-hmm. We are turning 18 this year. Mm-hmm. And we're voting this year.
Yeah, that's right.
We are voting this year, and we are not letting that vote. We're not holding that lightly. We're holding it very heavily. Mm-hmm. And we're going to use that to sway votes. To sway decisions, to sway what politicians focus on and what they think is important. We're going to show up. I'm turning 18 in 5 days, but just think about how many people are turning 18 today and from now until I turn 18, and we're all going to be voting in November.
In your curriculum, what are the things that they teach you about the civil rights movement?
Well, wow.
This is not a quiz.
You didn't come here to take a quiz. No, we're just curious. Like,
the reason I'm asking is because when I was your age, I wasn't learning about the civil rights movement outside of the context of the contributions of Martin Luther King, for example, right? And mm-hmm. and so we're also talking to Moctezuma Esparza on this episode, and he's someone that led 22,000 high school and other students on walkouts to protest things in his district in East LA, and this was in 1968. It was the largest student walkout in history at that point, and I never learned about him. Mm-hmm. And I never mm-hmm. learned about even Dolores Huerta or Cesar Chavez. Like, those were not things that I was learning in school. So I am wondering, is your generation learning about those parts of the civil rights movement?
Well, no, we're not. I have not heard any of the names that you just mentioned.
The studio's on fire.
But not because you're not learning about it.
No.
So one of the things that when we talked to Moctezuma that made me want to cry was when he said, you know, how hurt he is that 50 years after all the work that he did, people are still not learning about him and about the movement that Latinx people, that Chicanos led during the civil rights movement. So
also,
that's what makes me.
Me too, because it's not your fault by any means, nor was it our fault that we didn't learn. If anything, it's actually the fault of our generation and above for not insisting mm-hmm. that this is taught in schools. Mm-hmm. It's real frustrating to hear. It's real frustrating. So, wow.
No. Yeah, it is. It's very frustrating.
One question we wanted to talk about with regard to your identity as an Afro-Latina, you do identify as Afro-Latina, yeah? Or is that
I do.
You do, okay. And how does that influence your activism?
That influenced my activism specifically in recognizing the tables that I came from, and the people that now it is my responsibility to represent at the table, but also bring to the table, because I have an intersectional identity, as do many other people. But I cannot speak for every intersection, and I can't try to, because every story, every experience, every community deserves representation and the integrity to tell their own stories. So most of my work is focused on widening our scope of representation and authentic representation. Right now, we suffer from inauthentic representation in mainstream media, specifically right now for trans women and the stories of trans women and trans women of color. They're being taken. They're being written by people who are not transgender. They are being casted by people who are not transgender. The roles are being cast to actors who are not transgender. And the money is not going to actors, producers, directors, screenwriters, crew members who Scarlett are transgender.
Johansson. Yeah.
So it's now my responsibility, and I take it very willingly, to use my education. I'm studying film, to make sure that our identities are normalized, but normalized by us and us only. And that our stories are told by us and us only, and that we are, that we are offering, employment opportunities to these women and men and non-conforming individuals who have been, who have not been given jobs, who have not been given strong pathways to jobs, that now are not employed with money enough to seek adequate and comprehensive health care, and who are under attack by laws that now legalize and protect that very discrimination that leaves them without jobs, that leaves them without homes, that leaves them without support, that leaves them on the streets, that leaves them on the streets to turn to other forms of work that are not safe for them, that do not have protections for them, that just continue to continue to continue the cycle of oppression. So my way of tackling this is through advocacy through art. But that's just for me. And what I challenge and hope and ask all other young people to do is find a path to advocacy that is right for them. It does not have to be writing articles. It does not have to be creating films. Or it can be creating films. It can be writing theater pieces. It can be dance. But find a way that works for you, because what you want to do and the people that you want to liberate matter, and it's possible. And it's really important that we kind of take this this bubble from around advocacy, and what advocacy has to look like, and who can be an advocate. You can be your own advocate, and it starts there first.
I love amazing. That. It's so true.
I love that.
You know, these inadequacies that you're calling out, Grace, I think are the first and most important step to seek change, to actually see the needle move. And that's why just being a voice for your generation and coming out and talking to us today makes all the difference in the world. You know, we need to hear this too as a generation right above you, as millennials, because I think that we honestly could probably learn more from you guys than you guys can learn from us. Just as far as not only the respect that you give each other and the use of technology, but also the acceptance of the fact that there are so many diverse voices out there that need the space to be able to be heard. You're just like such a perfect voice for us to have represented on the show, and we're so glad that we got a chance to talk to you today.
Yeah, it was such a pleasure speaking with you and learning from you, and learning ways that things that we can learn from your generation to activate ours as well.
Yeah.
Grace, where can people find you? Because I want so many more people to follow the work that you're doing. So where can we do that?
You can find me on my most active social media which is Twitter. My at is at Grace Advocates. It's pretty straightforward. That's where you can find updates on what I'm doing, projects that I'm working on, where I'm featured, and where you can reach out and we can have a conversation. So I encourage everyone to do that.
Connect. Great. Thank you so much for taking
Thank
the time.
You. Thank you, Grace.
Thank you, Grace.
Thank you so much.
Julissa, this has been incredible for so many different reasons. I loved hearing the stories that you brought to the table. Hearing Moctezuma and hearing Grace talk about their advocacy makes you realize that these generations actually have a lot in common. All of us have a lot in common with the struggles that we face as Latinos. The struggles haven't ended by any means, but there have been victories along the way that I think we should celebrate. That's part of what we're doing.
And that we can look to.
Yes, yes.
To find hope and inspiration.
Yeah.
You know, I also think that it was amazing to have both Moctezuma and Grace on today's episode, because it just really goes to show that yes, we've made so much progress, but we still have so much work to do.
Yeah.
Because hearing Grace say that she had never heard of Moctezuma and never heard of Dolores Huerta,
yeah,
it really reminded me of how much work we still have to do to make sure that our history is being taught in schools.
Yes.
And that we continue to advocate and fight for ourselves and for our community.
And that we do that via the power of the vote, y'all. So if you have not registered with Vote Save America yet, please do that. We highly recommend it. It is just amping up right now, and there's a lot more for
more to come. There's a bunch of awesome new content that's going on VoteSaveAmerica.com. So you can go to VoteSaveAmerica.com to register to vote, but you can also find out about the most competitive races in your state and how you can get involved. You can watch some videos. There's just really amazing content on VoteSaveAmerica.com, so go check it out. I wanted to let listeners know that if you want to learn more about the types of stories that I shared with you today, the historical context, the amazing Latino civil rights leaders from the past, you can follow the hashtag 30 Days of Latinx, where I am sharing stories daily during Hispanic Heritage Month about these amazing people.
They're so good. Bye. See you next week.
Check them out. And buy my book, Someone
Bye,
Like Me.
Book. I have nothing to plug. I have Hysteria. That's it.
Yeah, listen to Hysteria.
Yeah, duh. And vote.
It's amazing. And vote. And buy my book, Someone Like Me.
See you next
Thank
week.
Thank you. See you next week.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at King's Island? The, holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The, make a splash all summer kind of fun. The, I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at King's Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun this season. King's Island is now open weekends.